And we're live. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Loose Cannon, the mentally exhausted from all the holidays edition. We were just talking about it before the show, just how the holidays have really worn us down. So if I if anyone listening or watching happens to feel like I am not mentally here, it's because I'm not. It's because I'm fucking I'm hanging on by a thread, and I've got what looked like about 8 inches of snow to go shovel once the show is done. So I've got interest on my exhaustion that's about to become due. How's it going, Rhino?
Good, man. It just finally started getting cold. Well, it got cold for a day or two last month, but it just finally started getting chilly.
What is cold for you? What temperature range is cold for you?
So I mean cold is cold, but it's 30 right now.
Okay. Yeah. Fair
And
enough.
so like 30 is cold, but then so you can't really ask a Texan anything about weather because we never get used to any one weather here ever, ever,
Oh, you
ever.
got a lot of
Because
highs and lows.
we go from 110 to 30 to tornado to hail to fucking, heat drought to floods all month. It's just like the, it's that dumb expression, if you don't like the weather in Texas, just wait a day.
Yeah. This is our first snowfall of the season.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like
We
we
prob we'll
had
probably get snow in April.
that's crazy. And it's crazy that we didn't get any snow in like November or December, like any at all. Like I don't want to say any at all. I think it might have snowed like once, but it didn't stick to the ground or anything. Like not even enough to like cause traffic issues. We had one day
Yeah.
where it was like torrential downpour for the entire day, and schools were closing just because of the flooding. And it was like, so
Yeah.
we've got floods, but we
Damn.
don't have snow.
That's the other thing in Texas is you never get used to the weather. So, like you mentioned, traffic.
Yeah.
One little drop of rain and like everybody
Oh.
wrecks.
Oh man, I
Or
cannot.
we get a little bit of sleet and everybody wrecks. It's really hot today, so everybody wrecks. It's just like,
It might just be your drivers.
yeah, I think just
At that
everybody wrecked.
point.
No, last week was a good traffic week, dude. It was really nice. I was driving 2 hours to and from the job site because it's far this time, and
Yeah.
it was actually pretty peaceful. What would normally take 2 hours was taking like an hour and a half.
2 hour drive. See, that's the other thing about like living in a big state, because you live in a massive state and I live in a tiny state. So if someone told me like you have to go somewhere, it's 2 hours away, I'd be like, Jesus fucking Christ, 2 hours away? I don't want to drive somewhere 2 hours away. Like an hour is like my upper limit of like, is it worth even going if it's more than an hour?
Right. Yeah, that's the other thing. Like Texas is four states in one, basically.
Yeah.
That's the area of that's how much area it is. So like I can get to Austin from here in 3 hours. But
Jesus
people
Christ.
in Texas don't really use mileage as a way or miles as a way to tell you how far something is because it means nothing unless you're talking locally. So it's kind of like in your state, you could go to a whole nother state in 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know,
And
but
I'm on the border of one, so it's like less
yeah.
than 2 hours. Very, 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 like less than 40 minutes, probably.
Yeah, like so for the 3 hours it would take for me to get to Austin, most of that time is spent just getting to the highway that goes to Austin
You're
and
fucking
then
kidding.
going from the highway to Austin. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah.
the highway in between is fast.
Yeah,
Like all the highways in between are fast.
we've got like maybe three or four highways going through Connecticut that actually get used, like highways, like interstates. And I don't know what
Yeah.
they're fucking supposed to be
Sure.
called. But yeah, we have snow, and I could never live in a state that is not like this because of just how bad people here react when we get snow. And I think it's fucking embarrassing. I mean, like you live in Connecticut. Like what are you? You should be used to this by now. They're like, oh, we might get like 4 inches to a foot of snow, and it's like, okay. So, do your shopping ahead of time, and just so you don't have to go out on snowy day. And that's it, right? Like that's all it should be. But people fucking panic, and it'll be like, it's always my own fault because I know it a week ahead of time, and I should take advantage of that time to do things like let me get my shopping done before the panic sets in, before that all happens, where it's like I just need to go grocery shopping. I can just pick up some fucking deli meat and bread, and I'll be good for a few days, and then the snow will be gone, and I won't have to worry about it. I can do the rest of my shopping. But like, I tried to get gas yesterday, and the line was like the gas station was like filled with fucking cars, and I'm like, well, I'm not getting gas now. I'm
Wow,
not going
dude.
into that because everyone's like, well, I need to have gas in my car before the snow comes. And it's like, why? Where are you going? How
That's
much is in your
weird.
tank right now that you need to fill up on gas today? And it's like, well, maybe the snow will knock out power is usually like the mentality. And it's like, yeah, maybe a little. And then where are you going? Like you going somewhere?
We get bad weather here, and people don't really prepare for it. They don't really panic for it. Like, they know if it's really severe, they know, and they'll go hit the shopping, the markets real hard. But one of two things about Texas is every highway dumps, like the highways are stupid here because every highway's exit, there's like a little micro city. And so it happens everywhere. So you get all these little suburbs that pop up around where these big highways exit and whatnot. And so everywhere there's a subway, excuse me, everywhere
Suburb.
there is a suburb, there's grocery stores. And so, for this stretch of highway, you could pass probably 10 suburbs with grocery stores and whatnot. And so people will hit the grocery stores, but there's always plenty of, crap, unless it's COVID. Everybody goes and gets toilet paper and takes it all. But
That's how it is with
anyway.
snow. It's just like everything is packed, everything is off the shelves. There's a Have you ever seen that video where the guy's making fun of it and it's like, oh, when the snow is coming, it's like I gotta get the bread and the milk. I gotta get the bread and the milk.
What?
Yeah.
What is that gonna do
Can
for
I
you?
just
So
do
the
my
other thing
regular
about
shopping? It's like I'm doing it a day early. It shouldn't be that much fucking harder. 'Cause normally I'd go shopping for the show today, like early in the morning. I'd go like right as the store opens, and I can't do that now that it's snowing. So I tried to do it yesterday or on Friday afternoon, and it was fucking like empty and packed, or empty of groceries, packed to people. I'm like, what the fuck?
See, that's the other thing I was going to say about Texas. So the second thing about Texas is when it's bad weather, everybody feels like it's an opportunity to go play in it.
Like in the
So,
street?
yeah, they'll just go out mudding or go out playing in the snow or running around like idiots in the hail. Or when a tornado comes down, they're like all standing in the street, like, I'm gonna throw a lasso around this thing. It's just people here are somewhat dangerous and chaotic when it comes to bad weather. They just love it. They think it's hilarious,
I mean, I guess I can't really talk.
unless you haven't really grown up here. Those people are sheltered up or
Yeah.
inside their closets.
When I was a kid, I remember, and that's what I was gonna say. I guess I can't really talk. I mean, there's a level to it, right? There's a level to like where you're fucking around and it's dangerous, and you're fucking around and it's okay. There was really bad snow, and it was so bad. Or I don't know why this was the case, but the snow was on the roads. It's like maybe they didn't salt. Maybe salting wasn't a thing when I was a kid back then, and I just never realized. But the snow was like packed down onto the street, right? And I had a friend who lived next door. His dad had a truck, and his dad was gonna go somewhere, and so he's like backing out, and me and my buddy, Evan, I think, whatever, we were hiding, waiting for him to pull out, of the driveway, pull out back. Or pull backwards out of it. And so as he pulled back out of it, just before he was about to start going forward, we like r quickly ran out and grabbed onto the back of his truck, and he started driving, and we were sliding on the snow, holding onto the back of his truck. And like he went like a block before he noticed us, and he's like, "Get the
That's
fuck
funny.
off my truck." But we weren't
That's a
doing anything
regular
wrong.
occurrence around here. I'm looking forward to seeing the idiots doing that when it sleets over or ices over, you know.
Before we get into the Destiny things, I said I wanted to share this with you because I think it'd be funnier if you heard it live. I'm a little embarrassed to say I do not have a yellow book of notes for this episode, which should be for notes for week 4, 5, and 6, because on week 4 we got the exotic mission and I could not fucking do it. I got to what I'm positive is the final boss, and it was so frustrating getting there that when I finally got there, and I've tried this 2 times now, and when I finally got to the final boss, I just couldn't get the rhythm of it, of like doing damage, handling adds, making sure I keep the buffs up, and all that stuff. And it just made me so mad that I would rage quit. And I was like, I'm not, if I get that mad at something, I just stop playing. And I've just yet to ask my friends to be like, "Hey, can you help me?" 'Cause I'm not getting this done.
Well,
So
you
we
weren't doing
will.
it solo, were you?
I was.
Oh, you
Is
were?
it
Oh,
not supposed to be
damn.
soloed?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure people do it, but I'm not that crazy.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I'm sure like once I learn how to do it won't be that hard, 'cause like I solo most all the I've soloed every exotic mission so far.
Sure.
And I've heard this one isn't even as difficult as others have been. And it's just like you say that, but it's pissing me off. So like I'm just not in the space for it. So I could say like the one page of notes I have on week 4 before I started to rage quit, but it's really just like we talked to Riven. Riven sent us to do the things. We do the things. Soul Divisive. There was a big thing with the oracles appearing outside the Vault of Glass, which should be
Yeah, that was
impossible.
interesting. What is that?
And so like Osiris is predicting that they're actually tapping into the witness's power to better predict the future and make themselves smarter, which that's scary to think about. That feels like the type of thing like that's kind of like Bungie planting a seed for post Final Shape content, which is pretty fun.
Interesting.
And then they have the fake out boss where it's way too easy. And then the egg gets stolen by the Soul Divisive, and Riven loses her shit, and she's like, she demands we wish for the egg to be returned, and she's like, "I will grant it, wish it," and we're like, "We're not doing that." And we go see Crow, and he's like, "Go to the Black Garden. Hey, remember when I was Aldrin and I said you needed a Gatelord eye?" He makes a joke about that, and that's when we do the mission. And in the mission, Riven has a secret way into the Black Garden. I did see the cutscene, but so as you're like experiencing it firsthand, Riven has a secret way into the Black Garden. And when we get in there, Crow starts hearing whispers. We hear them as well. But Crow mentions how like he heard those whispers before, and that was when Riven was manipulating him. And Riven's like, "These whispers aren't mine," and that theme kind of keeps happening where like Crow asks what this place is and Riven's like, "It's an Ahamkara lair." And he goes, "Is it yours?" And she goes, "You've seen mine." And then, we come across the first energy source. I forgot what it was called. Because once you have them both, it becomes, the buff sources, the little pools.
Yeah, the little pools that you stand in to shoot down the one boss in each symbol.
Yeah, the blue one is Riven's energy, and it had its own name. But when you get them,
I didn't even notice there were different colors.
and so Riven's energy helps you defeat Taken that are otherwise protected. And so it had its own name. I can't remember it, but when you have both of them, I think it's called Dragon's Favor. And the second one, the orange energy, lets you pass through barriers that are not just a single door. They're kind of like a hallway or perhaps even a room. And when you do not have that buff, you take damage and you die. And the second one is called Ram's Favor. No, that's not right. The name Ram was in there. And so we come across the second energy source, the orange energy source, and we're very much like, the fuck is this now, Riven? And Riven's like, that's not mine. Making it very, very obvious where the story was going before the cutscene is revealed that this is another Ahamkara's lair and probably Riven's mate. And the cutscene reveals that yes, it was Riven's mate, and they did make the clutch of eggs together. Which I don't know how much I believe that. So do you remember on our last episode, I shared the theory that I was kind of working on, and my clanmate Dan had mentioned that Riven planted the wish of the eggs in our heads. So we wish for the eggs' existence, and that's why they exist, and that's how Ahamkara actually reproduce. And it's like, so at any point, this story about the second Ahamkara, who was like kind and generous to her, like maniacal and greedy, could be fake, or it could be real. Maybe you do need to. Maybe there was a second Ahamkara that she did enjoy her company with, and that's why she decided to have a brood. And they do it like asexually, you know, like.
Sure. And it just happens.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like how does that work in? You know, that's funny. This isn't a continuation of what you're saying, but it's something that happened as far as the dialogue for I can't remember if I heard it in the coil when that was happening, or if it was just a part of like the weekly thing with Riven. But there was a point when Riven says, and this has been a long-held theory of mine, one of them. She says, "Yeah, well, how do you think you got the weapons you're holding? I'm in those. I am the one that helped you get those, or we're the ones that help you get those. Like the Ahamkara are the weapons and the reason why we got the weapons that we seek and the hunger for that." So, I've always had this weird thing in the back of my mind since the beginning of Destiny. And it was because of, you know, some of the Ahamkara themed crap that we had in D1, that the reason why Guardians have this insatiable hunger for loot and weaponry is because it was part of our desire that was wished from the Ahamkara, and the Ahamkara made it so. And there's a really cool thing if you look at the little kiosk where you can go and buy past exotics and stuff. If you look at for far away, it looks like it's two guardians standing by a shield or something like that with swords. But if you look far away enough from it, it looks like an Ahamkara skull. I'll put it back up on Twitter again, but I did it a long time ago because I was just like, wait, what's going on here? And then all of these things with Ahamkara that are coming to, you know, to light now just make me go back to old theories and pull up old stuff. Like I was looking at Cade's ship in D1, and I had forgotten there was an Ahamkara skull in there. And I was just like, Jesus, dude, these things have been around forever. You know, the one above Shaxx's head, you know, in the Crucible bounties and whatnot. And so that being said, it's just funny that some of the dialogue that we've been hearing have things to do with our desire to get weapons. And there was some stuff about Crucible too that happened. I guess it was 2 weeks ago. Something about Shaxx and the Crucible and Ahamkara. You know, like it's also cool because we've heard it in past dialogue with like Savathun's ghost saying, "Oh yeah, I like to watch the Crucible matches. This is pretty cool how you just kill yourself or kill each other." You know, like all of that wrapped up in a tiny bow is kind of like, are we really the engine that we believed at the beginning of D1, you know, that's feeding the great machine or whatever? You know, who knows? So, you know, whether that be the pyramid or the traveler, are we really just tithing somehow? just not in the conventional ways that we know about in game.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That really makes me wonder if and it's like it's one of those things that I'm like, I'm positive this isn't gonna ever be a story beat, but you kind of put the thought in my head. What if the traveler wished for a force to fight the witness?
Damn.
And it's
Okay.
like, all right, that's how Guardians got created. And to make sure that the Ahamkara got a fair bet on it, it's like, and Guardians are going to be like just fucking loot crazy. Because that's a thing
Right.
that is brought up a lot, how Guardians are absolutely loot crazy. And it's just like, it's not
Well,
just some Guardians, it's every Guardian ever is
it's every
absolutely loot
guardian,
driven.
yeah. Yeah, like there's even funny dialogue like, how do you get a guardian to do something? Just dangle some loot in front of them, you know,
Yeah.
dangle a fancy gun in front of them. I think that's in like a item lore somewhere.
Yeah. So, and it
Anyway.
would make sense. It would make sense that if the ghosts were created in part by an Ahamkara wish, that part of the reconstruction of a corpse to a guardian or a corpse to a risen would be that they have like an overflow of desire. And that's why,
Interesting.
like, but, huh. I wonder, maybe this will happen.
Who knows, man?
Because
Who knows?
Riven said when she first laid eyes on a guardian, she knew that everything changed. I wonder, like,
Oh, yeah, because then that would imply that she saw a universe before the Guardian and it was shaped differently. And so when the
yeah.
Guardian arose, she saw a different, she was like, oh, okay, I can see now. Yeah,
Yeah.
that kind of dialogue implies things like that. So, you know, you little things like that happen in game, and at the time you just it throws away.
Yeah.
But when you I think it's crazy how many times we've found things like that inside really interesting lore. Like there'll be a lot of funny things happening, but then there'll just be this one little dial or this one little throwaway line, and it later ends up being like the big revelation.
Yeah, 'cause I remember on our last episode, for those who didn't see or had forgotten, when I first heard Riven say that, and I had this idea that like we were actually housing the eggs par because Ahamkara are parasites collecting
Sure.
the eggs, and I thought somehow we would contribute to the birth of a new generation of Ahamkara. When Riven said that when she first laid eyes on Guardians, she knew that everything would change for the Ahamkara, like for their future. I took
Right.
that to mean that Ahamkara were kind of like xenomorphs from the series Aliens, where
Yeah, that was cool.
they implant their eggs into a host body, and then a new type of xenomorph emerges based on what
Yeah.
that host body is. And that'd be
Interesting.
crazy if that were true. Is both could be true. You know, both of those statements do not cancel each other out. Like Ahamkara could
Sure.
have helped create ghosts, and Ahamkara like a sp it's making me mad how much sense it makes.
Yeah. I know. I know. Well, and I don't want to spoil anything because I read all of the lore items and, you know, everything that happened. And there was some murmuring about Crow, which everybody knows about now, but I'm just not going to go into that. But there's some really interesting stuff that I read like day two after it dropped in on Ishtar, and I read everything.
I need to be
But
better
there
about
was some,
reading it.
oh my God, there was some stuff in there. I was just like, y'all are not ready for this. So there's at the end of this season, there's going to be something really cool that people are going to see. And I don't know if we're going to see it in a cutscene. I don't know if we're going to see it just a part of a mission or whatever, but it's either going to be said or seen. And oh my God, when I read it, I was like, holy crap,
So
y'all are not ready for this.
you think it's something that's not intended to be seen yet?
No, I don't
Okay.
think so, because
Yeah.
there were like four items in there that speak specifically on it. And I think they were accidentally, or they were put in there maybe. Maybe they
Yeah.
were put in there intentionally just because, you know, they knew that regardless of what happens, this didn't really confirm anything, but as far as I go, as far as you go, as far as what we know in Bungie's history, it's damn well confirmed.
It's really
So
frustrating. Sorry.
yeah.
It
But so like I know other people have already data mined it and looked up other stuff even and seen like other things, but those things until they're actually in the game or said explicitly, it didn't happen.
Hmm. It's really frustrating how Bungie will have the books for the season be redacted. I think they're still redacted in the API today. So
Yeah,
like
they are.
you can't even see the first entry despite
And
being
they're
on week
so good
six.
this time. Dude, this
Yeah.
time I wanted to talk about them so bad because the Dragon Slayer, the Slayer lore book is so good. It's so good.
And but then at the same time, they have in the API the seasonal quests, which maybe
Let's
it
talk
doesn't
right
like,
about it.
yeah, which maybe doesn't give like the cutscene away, but it will give like little bits and pieces away. Like the seasonal
And that's what I'm
quest,
speaking about.
yeah, the seasonal quest last season was just freely in the API as well. And it was like, I think one of them was collect the Ahamkara egg. And it's like, excuse me? What do you mean?
Which we all thought at the time was just going to be that corrupted one.
I didn't.
I did. I thought it was just going to be another corrupted egg. I thought we were just going to have a whole season of Taken and stuff, sort of, but
We already
that wasn't the
we're kind of
case.
getting that. It's Taken and Vex, but it is still Taken. They're kind of running out of enemies by making everybody on our side.
How could Taken even be on our side? That would be funny. Oh, we should probably do the lore card.
Yeah, sorry. Well, yeah, and so before we got into the book, we had this. We just reversed the order. So brought to you from Destiny Armor Defined is our weekly lore card.
Cool. Thorn was the absolute terror of last week's Crucible. I think it was like the most used weapon or something,
Really?
according to according to
That's
certain
surprising.
websites and whatnot. Yeah, I thought so too. And it was funny because I had it queued up to talk about anyway, but I was just like, wow. So this lore card, it's pretty cut and dry, but the cool thing about it is it's an ornament for Thorn,
Yeah.
and it's called Essentialism. And on the face of it, you don't really, seem to really care too much about the word. You just kind of like think, oh, Essentialism, I guess it's just something to do with, the traveler and the witness. When you look at the gun, it's got a really cool look to it. It has the what happened in the raid where the traveler hits the pyramid ship and it makes the rainbow effect of the beautiful, like sharp, glassy looking stuff. And then what's even cooler is down where the eye would normally be, or the green little thing, it's planet. Or like how they lined up the planets for
Oh
the
shit.
for yeah. It's really cool looking. And even the textured surface of the gun looks like a pyramid ship. So it's kind of like a miniaturized version of the raid in your hand,
Yeah,
which is
I didn't see the little planets they have on the side there. That's really cool. It looks like it's actually Earth and the Moon specifically, and then
yeah, I
there's like
think
just
so.
two empty spaces. But I did obviously notice the very upfront like pyramid ship texture with the light infection kind of spreading across it, prismatic. But before you go any further, can I just say, does this look like 3D printed to you?
It does, yeah, because mainly because of the texture lines, like the
Yeah.
lines from the pyramid ship. So, yeah, if you 3D printed this gun, it would probably look pretty good,
It
huh?
would look very thematic.
Yeah, it's funny. The barrel even is gold, and I think that's just more or less like how the pyramid has those spire like the adornments in there, the spires and stuff like that are gold. So that's a part of that theme. But what's interesting about this is if you're holding the gun and you're firing it forward, that traveler glassing effect that went across the pyramid, it's like it's going that way. So in my mind, I'm like, okay, so the artist is definitely cueing onto something with the name of the gun as far as essentialism goes. So if you think about I dare to say iconography, but like the idea of the image, the aesthetics of the gun and how you would use it, and thematically it's the way it looks. What does this mean specifically for the word essentialism? So let's get into it. So essentialism is a philosophical school of thought, and its origins are in ancient Greek. And it's the idea that entities have essential qualities or characteristics that are intrinsic, immutable, which represent the fundamental essence of what that entity is and ultimately defines their true nature. So what the hell does that mean? Well, basically, the origins of essentialism can be traced to ancient Greece by the prominent philosopher Plato. In Plato's philosophy, he posited that that existence of ideal forms or essences that represent true nature of entities separate from their physical manifestations. So there's like a little diagram in there too, which just kind of shows about Plato's theory. But the imagery for Plato's theory is very much a sphere that is, split into triangles. So there's all of these shapes that come about from the sphere. And so the sphere, the true form is the sphere, which is called the triangularity. And then all of the triangles can be attributed to its final shape, which would be the triangularity. And so all of these triangles are named, and we use them in maths and all kinds of different geometries and whatnot. So there's isosceles, equilateral, acute, right, obtuse, and scalene. We all know these from, rudimentary math in high school and whatnot. But I found it really interesting because the game, we're dealing with triangles versus a sphere, right? Pyramids versus a sphere. So all these different triangular shapes. And then so essentialism is stripping everything down to a true nature. And so what is the true nature and how do we derive a true nature? So Plato decided that there had to be basically core concepts or essences or ideal forms for every true nature, right? And so there's your highest point, which would be your transcendence and your peak experience of anything. Then below that is your need for self-actualization. And then below that is your aesthetic needs. And then below that is your need for understanding. And then below that is your self-esteem. And then below that is your need for love and belonging. And then below that is safety. And then below that, your basic is your physical needs, you know. So Plato was really kind of like on the forefront of all of this essentialism. And it's cool. It's a cool little thought experiment to engage in now because it kind of teaches us some things about our own true natures. Not only personally, like, with whatever you're dealing with, but physical world types of things. So for example, the ideal essence of a chair would be the purest and most perfect version of that chair, right? So everything outside of that is purely like layers upon that. So like just what I was saying before you get into everything else about that chair, its purest form is its true nature. So like you can sit on it, it's a chair. It does something, right? And that's purely designed to do its function. And then on top of that, there are adornments, things that you can put on there, like meaning, who built it, all of these things that you can attribute to the chair to make it more than what it is. And then ultimately, the chair can be become so great and ascend to such a high level of transcendence or whatever, that it's invaluable. Like it's priceless, basically. So, essentialism, if you take that chair thought and attribute it to humanity and people, essentialism is kind of like the same idea. But now we're talking about people and what are you, what is your true nature? And so if I stripped everything away from you that I would see and observe, I could get to your core true nature somehow. And so that's basically what this is. So the cool thing about essentialism is it underwent a resurgence in the 19th and 20th century. So there's a huge gap, but these later philosophers took essentialism and redefined it or helped, elaborate more on it. And so there's, these philosophers, G.W. Leibniz, Edmund Husserl, and Ludwig Wittgenstein. And so they stripped it down to the hierarchy of knowledge. So there's at the top the truth and the good, and then down at the bottom it would just be like your imagination, right? So somewhere in the middle are all these levels to the truth and the good. And what do we deal with in destiny? We deal with, hungering and knowledge and trying to get to the truth or the good, the inherent good is what they would say. And then Plato even kind of said that too, but his was a little bit more stripped down. There's like the appetites of your soul, then there's the spirit, and then there's reasoning. Like your reasoning, like, is really the truth of where all that comes from. And then, there's also like Eckhart Tolle touched on this. He said, at the base, there's your thoughts and feelings. And then at the top, there's the part of the mind that's aware of what the mind is thinking and feeling. And that's your ultimate awareness, So it's really interesting. There's a cool little Venn diagram that kind of talks about Plato's philosophy. And so in this one, this is really kind of the key thing about essentialism. In its purest form, it refers to the idea that entities have an essential quality or characteristic that defines their true nature. So these essential qualities are seen as intrinsic and immutable, and they represent the essence of what that entity truly is. So, like, if you said, what is the drifter? Right? You have all of these layers and all of these character personalities, all these fancy stories, all of these things. If you strip all that away, how do you get to the true, his true nature? Well, we've seen it in game, because time and time again, he's kind of proven that, yeah, he's kind of a good guy, right? How he deals with Aeris, how he deals, and it shows compassion for Sloane, stuff like that. So on the surface and the stories that we know about him, you have a wild imagination as to what kind of character this guy has. He's a cannibal, or he's, just he's crazy, or he's a thief, or he's a bad guy. All of these things that he tells you he is, they're really just layer on top of layer on top of layer of the true nature, which is that he's inherently good,
Do you think
so.
I have to actually stop you there, because now that you're talking about Drifter, you make a really good point. The actions that we see him make are not the same that of the actions we hear he has made. And do you think he actually like eats aliens and shit, or is that just like all a front?
I would dare to say that it's an elaboration on some basic thing that probably one or two times something similar happened, like he tasted something or tried something or, had to survive. Like he's all about survival, which is what everybody is at their core experience in this game. We're all trying to survive. So you'll do anything you can to survive. Now, is that inherently good or bad? I think those moral dilemmas are attributed by people like us because we're trying to reconcile, like would you rather die or eat a human corpse in the snow so that you could live one day longer? You know what I mean? So like,
I think the easier and more likely analogy here with the Drifter, not an analogy, but with the Drifter, is that Mithrax, I think it was Mithrax, and has actually talked about how, like, even the Fallen don't like go hunting for humans, but they were starving and there was an enemy and they needed to eat, and there's probably humans that did the same thing back to the Fallen. Drifter's probably one of them, and he probably didn't like it. You know, he was probably just like, oh, I can't believe I have to do this to survive, but I have to do this to survive. And then he's like, but this will really freak people out and that'll keep me safe.
So let's keep the story going, you know. And so I picked the Drifter to talk about because specifically this has to do with Thorn and you know, Thorn and the Drifter's, you know, whole saga of events with killing the followers of Yor and stuff like that. I thought it was kind of neat to think about, you know, that particular character. Because when you strip everything away, all of that story, all of those fantastic character perspectives that gave us this really cool image of a character in game were truly just, you know, cool stories, right? But we keep them going because they're fun, right? You know, like nobody wants to lose that really neat imagery of the Drifter, you know, being, let's be bad guys, you know, playing around with stuff he shouldn't be. But at the core of it all, you know, he's trying to survive.
I think you might have changed my beliefs on the Drifter a bit there. So good job for that.
That Venn diagram kind of shows how at the core of everything there's, you know, your true nature. And then so where they overlap, there's the axiology, the epistemology, and then dualism. So dualism is the two worlds, or the imperfect body, your perfect form, which is your soul, and then ontology, like the question of what is real. You've heard ontology in game a lot too. And then where they overlap, you know, there's axiology, which is idealism, the pursuing the ideal up and up and up, basically ascending to your mind over matter, right? Like being able to conquer your mind in a way that allows you to ascend any type of physical form or matter, right? You know what I'm saying? So like if you can somehow meditate to a higher being, you've transcended your mortal, you've shed your mortal coil, like your body, your form. Anyway, that's basically what that is. And then epistemology, which is your rationalism, your thought, your sense of the truth versus deception. So like, how do you rationalize all of these things around you? How do you rationalize Drifter as being a good person? Or how do you, you know what I mean? So all of those three thoughts will overlap and give you Drifter's true nature in the center. So like if you, okay, what are his two imperfect body slash forms? What is real? What is his axiology? What is his epistemology? And then you come up with the overlap, which is at the central of it. And it's like, okay, well, I guess Drifter's a good guy. And I'll just, yeah, go ahead.
Because you really got to me with the Drifter. You really got me fucking thinking about him. Do you remember that web lore that we got back? I think it was in Season of the Drifter where the Warlock Anor of the Praxic Order was trying to convince Ikora that the Drifter was dangerous and that Gambit was dangerous and all this stuff. And like Drifter is like, so you get the one perspective of the Drifter who's this kind of charismatic guy, and he finds this like maintenance worker sweeping up debris off the ground, and he's like, hey, let me take care of that for you. And the maintenance was like, oh my God, thank you so much. And he's like, haha, I'm gonna use this disguise to sneak in and hear what they're talking about. And then a little bit later, you get the other perspective of Ikora and Anor, and they're like, the fuck is Drifter doing? Like, does he not understand how obvious it is that he's spying on us right now? And I think he did know how
Oh, you think
obvious
he
it
did?
was.
He was just keeping up the look, like the
Yeah,
deception, like
he was so fucking big brain that he on purpose did an obvious stunt of trying to spy on someone so that they would go,
That's
look at him.
hilarious.
He's trying to spy on us. He's a bad guy. And he goes, no, I'm not.
That's funny. I don't want to talk it to death because I think it's a high-minded concept already, essentialism, but I would like to strip it down real quick just so that people can digest it a little bit easier, because it's not as crazy as we make it out to be. But the key concepts of essentialism are neat because they tie into this whole thing of base elements, triangles, circles, stuff like that, things we deal with in game. And I think that the Bungie writers really they look for these cool concepts that are in the real world to help explain or write more stories for us. And I think this is one of them. It's just kind of like this cool idea that they can kind of like touch on in game and make your mind spin a little bit. So the key concepts of essentialism is, number one, the essentialists believe that every object or individual possesses inherent properties that distinguish them from others. So these properties are considered fundamental and necessary for the existence of that particular entity. So that's the first one. And then the second one is natural kinds, which essentialism suggests that objects can be classified into natural kinds based on their essential properties. So, for instance, a natural kind could be mammals with essential properties, such as giving birth to living young and having mammary glands, and that makes them mammals, right? But I put on here a diagram which has been used for to describe what are natural kinds, and so they're classifications that it's kind of like the Venn diagram, but put in a sphere or triangle, whatever you want to call it. But where fire, air, water, and earth connect, there are sub elements which are the basically the characteristics of those elements. So fire is hot. Air can also be hot, so in between there's hot, right? And then air and water, where they intersect, is wet. And then water and earth, it could be cold. And then earth and fire could be dry. And so all of these base elements that they're trying to say is that they derive from one central essentialism, right? And so you get into the third thing, which is that there is a fixed identity. So that picture is kind of a good one for that, because the fixed identity shows that essentialism holds an entity's essential properties and give it a fixed identity that remains constant across time and different circumstances. So regardless of what happens, that fixed identity will always exist, so this view rejects the notion of change or variability in an entity's fundamental nature. So this is where we get kind of like controversial, because people ask this question all the time: can somebody change? Can or is or are people just always the way they've always been, or are they always going to be who they are no matter what? So like you've heard the expression before, he showed his true colors, right? That's where this comes from. So like when somebody says, oh, he showed us who he really is, or at the base core of of it all, he was this way or she was this way, or wow, they really showed us who they are today. All of those expressions come from this idea that if you strip everything away from somebody, you can get to their true nature, right? Whatever. So the fourth one is the last one, which is categorization and classification, and it's what we use to define everything. Like here we are, the damn word essentialism. We're defining a thought. We name everything. Cat is cat, dog is dog, refrigerator is refrigerator. So these are the names that we give to the world around us and classify things. So essentialism is basically relevant because in biology, anthropology, and linguistics, it helps to categorize and classify objects, organisms, and languages based on their essential characteristics. So if you look at this gun and you say, oh, that's thorn underneath, right? You strip everything away and you're like, oh, well, that's thorn underneath there. That's you can figure it out. So if thorn changed, or if the gun that was the gun before it became thorn changed, how do you give that new form its new name, right? So you have to look at it, you have to see what it where it came from, and you have to see what it was called before, and then that kind of leads you into the new name it gets as it's changing. So that's where I think they were trying to go with this word essentialism is like, yeah, that's a pyramid ship. Yeah, it's the traveler's energy wiping across the pyramid. It looks just like the raid, but guess what? It's thorn underneath. What does that mean? Right? So anyway, in, as far as the controversy goes, essentialism has faced criticism and challenges, but it's because people that they argue that it oversimplifies really complex systems by focusing solely on those inherent properties. But it can also be seen as limiting because it does not accommodate for variances and changes and contextual influences. So if you dive too hard into essentialism, you could end up having a very narrow view of the world around you. You could be very prejudiced if all you thought was essentialism every day. So that's the
All
lore
right.
card. Sorry it was so complex.
No, I mean it was fun to talk about Drifter and stuff, and it's interesting to
Yeah.
hear. That's why I love the lore cards. They make you think about different things different ways.
Yeah.
It's a very valuable knowledge.
Well, hey, listen, lore cards are here for one reason is my own, selfish reasoning is because I don't know what the hell any of this stuff is and I want to know. So I go look it up and then, I learn something and I like learning cool things, especially when it forces me to experience knowledge in a way that's entertaining versus just looking up something or being told something.
Yeah. All right. So, are we ready to do some reading?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So, for this week, mainly because, and maybe, because obviously I'm stunted by my lack of progress. How many entries are in the books? Is it like nine?
Looks like there's quite a few.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, oh my God, there's 21. Where
Oh,
who's there?
no, not in Tales of the
Oh, am I
Forgotten.
looking at
In
the right
Tales of the
thing?
Forgotten, there's 33 entries. I knew that. I
Oh.
meant in the books of this season.
Oh.
Is it 'cause
Oh.
usually it's like one a week for the 9 weeks of story, right? So like
Yeah. So
maybe.
there's not that many. There's like five or something,
Oh,
right?
yeah, because we're 6 weeks in.
Yeah. And they're good. Is that what you mean?
No, but I don't know how
Okay.
long I
Yeah,
want to
I got you.
spend on it. What I meant was I was going to try to see if I can find a non-API source for the books so that we can maybe do them on next episode. If they're finished, if they're very close to being finished, maybe not. In any case,
I really hope they are because I don't want them to wait to give them out until the very end, which is like
yeah.
a month away. That's shit.
It's so weird what they decide to redact and what they don't. But that's they're doing. So at least for now, we have the 33 entries of Tales of the Forgotten Volume 3. We've been reading entries more often, and I think that's more fun. I think it's probably more fun to listen to rather than just like a shitty summarization. Even if there's nothing exciting in the entry, it's probably just more fun to just be able to like, all right, let's just kick back and listen to someone read to me. So we're just gonna read these and we'll give our thoughts in between, and however far we get by the time we're done is how far we'll get by the time we're done. Because there's no shot in hell we're finishing this book with the amount of time we have left.
Yeah, there's no way.
So you want me to read chapter one? I'll start. So chapter one, the Tower Bazaar was beginning to wake with activity as Ido sighed and placed her data pad on the table in front of Crow's ghost. Glint, this research on the hall between has me thinking about stories, the ones that evoke fear. the scary ones, as you've said. Like the ones about the drowned captain, Glint asked. Exactly, she said. My father told me not so long ago that odes are for hatchlings, but throughout our research on the Hall Between and the Headless Ones, I've discovered that people of all ages and backgrounds enjoy these tales of dread, regardless of the academic merit or accuracy. So I'd like to make something similar for people to enjoy. I want to try writing my own. That's a wonderful idea. What will you write first? Well, I'm not exactly sure. I need some inspiration. Oh, I'd love to help. Now, the first thing to know about scary stories is that sometimes nothing is as scary as the truth. Very cute, and that's all holiday entries need to be. Do you like scary stories and all that?
I mean, I like them. I don't read enough to really get into them, but yeah, what I do read, I do.
Yeah, I love scary stories. Like, I read a lot.
I even like the scary stories during the Christmas season too. That's, the
Yeah.
holiday season. Sorry. But the
Christmas
like
season's
what we
fine.
would I know, but it I don't celebrate, like I celebrate American Christmas,
Yeah.
which is go shopping, get presents, and love your family.
I don't even know if I
That's
celebrate
really what I
that.
care about. You know what I mean? And so, like, when people talk about these like holidays as a concept, I fundamentally, they just, to me, fundamentally, I don't practice any of that original crap. But what they've morphed into nowadays, like Halloween, it's fine. I
Yeah.
like it. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. I like to read that stuff. But I love folklore, and I love stories that come from, a really long time ago, and I've noticed that even today's modern tales, are very obviously drawing upon old stuff. So I like to see how people, do their cover songs of past stories, basically, put their spin on it, So it's interesting, but yeah,
Yeah,
it's all in one way or another, just a regurgitation.
I absolutely love scary stories. I read a lot of horror comics in particular, actually,
Oh, cool.
and so like I have to organize them all. I have them on the table just because my box is full. Because I'm very good at buying them. I'm not very good at keeping them organized. So they just kind of pile up and they get put places. But I have this one. It's a very, very scary, very graphic story. It's about Christmas. So it kind of, oh wait, no, we're doing Halloween. I thought this was a Dawning Lore book. It's about a serial killer who dresses as Santa.
That's
And
funny.
it was much more graphic than I was expecting it to be, but I do like it. I was kind of thinking it was going to be like a campy Scream slasher, not like a no, this is a real serial killer.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. It's fun to see that that Ido is basically going to take her shot at writing some scary stories for all ages.
Well, there's a lot of cool little funny nods to things outside of the stories too in this. So I'll read the next one. So chapter two, the room Eris had stuck Imaru in was minuscule. There were no windows to watch the hours and days pass by, no electronics to hack, just containers of decommissioned armor stacked against the far wall, and one small empty crate in the middle of the room, adorned with handwritings, sign that simply said "you," and an arrow pointing menacingly downward. It was placed there as a warning after he was caught lurking around the more sensitive areas of the tower. Ikora had confiscated his shaded shell disguise and placed the hidden agent somewhere outside to report on his every move. She did, however, leave some blank crossword pages for him. Imaru stared at the crate, emitting a low-pitched growl as a lone sweeper bot entered, surprising the ghost. He circled, then scanned his random and unexpected visitor. It was standard issue, nothing special. Imaru was disappointed. I still can't believe Savathun would do this to me, Amaro said to the bot as he flew directly into its face. The nerve of it all, leaving me here as collateral and then to ask for information? He watched the bot shuffle away and broom the open crate. Then again, who says I have to share everything? Amaro swooped around, quickly hacking into the sweeper bot's systems. Grab an empty kit bag from over here. Should be just the right size if I remove a little weight. As the bot compiled, Amaro chuckled, shedding his standard hive shell. Right, time for a jailbreak. So Amaro turned into a sweeper bot.
Yeah, well, grab an
That's
empty kit
crazy.
bag from over here. Should be just the right size if I remove a little weight. What's a
Yeah.
kit bag?
I think he was looking for. Let's see. Amaro would run quickly, hacking into the sweeper bot system. Grab an empty kit bag. I think he was just testing the sweeper bot's frame, like the frame of doing what he wanted it to do.
Okay, so you think he's actually in the sweeper bot? Because I think he used the sweeper bot. I guess why couldn't he just do it himself?
Okay. Yeah, that's what he did. You're right. He didn't become a sweeper bot. He just is in the bag that the sweeper bot is holding.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
Yeah, okay.
what
You're
I
right.
thought it was.
Yeah, okay.
But
Well, I read too hard in that one.
it'd be funny if he was a sweeper bot. That'd be really funny.
Yeah. He's just using the sweeper bot to carry him around, but he is telling the sweeper bot what to do because he hacked it.
Yeah, I haven't
Okay.
read this book yet, so we'll find out.
Yeah.
Chapter 3. After a few arduous attempts and one superbly acted sob story told to an incredibly gullible ghost, Imaru eventually sauntered off in a new constricting shell. In his latest disguise, he skulked through the halls and hangars and workshops, scanning everything and anything he could find on his way to the courtyard. There, he hovered among the gnarled branches of a giant tree, nearly invisible among the colorful lanterns adorning it. He watched the guardians meditate among candles, the flames flickering in the breeze. Others, dressed as insects and arachnids, gleefully danced or bobbed for apples, their revelry flanked by a pair of guardians galloping with coconut shells. Amid the flurry of costumes and masks, his gaze finally settled on people sharing small wrapped objects. Amaru gingerly floated closer to the base of the tree to get a better look. "Hey, move along, pal. I saw the candy first," a voice sneered from behind him.
Yeah.
I love it when they address the absurdity of the player
Yeah.
character like this,
Emotes.
wearing the new armor set of either
Yeah.
beetles or spiders and the fucking Monty Python gallop.
Yep, with the coconut shells,
Yeah,
so
with the
good.
coconut
Yeah.
shells. It's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. So chapter 4. I called dibs on that candy. Don't make me say it again. Maru turned to see another ghost as she made a beeline for the candy on the ground beneath him. You are. Wait, what are you wearing? You dipped your shell in human food? And Maru spat. The other ghost sighed. It's a caramel apple shell. You dolt. If you knew anything, you'd recognize how special it is. Looks sticky. It's a delicacy. Note the elegant ornamentation of. Fresh toffee bits, she said and spun around. If you haven't lost your self-respect yet, allow me to lose it on your behalf, he shot back. Her iris narrowed, and as she fixated on Amaru's shell, I'm surprised your guardian didn't dress you up like a lemon, she scoffed. I ain't got no guardian, Amaru sniffed. The other ghost bobbed toward him. Wait, you're in partner too? I knew there were more of us out. Happy Festival of Lost Friends. Oh no. Amaru and the other ghosts groaned in unison as they faced the cheerful glint.
Oh, people don't like Glint.
You know, glint was pulled pork, so like glint is the goober that is amongst all the ghosts. Like he's the
That's a good point. He probably is. Yeah, you're right. You're not wrong. So chapter 5. The toffee-covered ghost transmitted away the second she heard Glint's voice. Unfazed, Glint approached the snake-covered ghost, determined to meet a new friend. Hello, stranger. Are you enjoying the festival? Get lost, Amaru snark. I have to say
So mean
something.
to
It's
him.
no, but not just that. I have to say something. It's ridiculous that a ghost can just remove their shell and they're a different person now to everyone around them. They're like, oh, you must be new. I've never seen you before.
That's funny.
Get lost, Amaru snarled, and Glint jumped back in surprise. Amaru, okay, so at least he recognizes his voice. You be quiet, will ya? I trying to enjoy this festival incognito, Amaru whispered. Glint quietly stared back for a moment. You broke out of Eris's crate, huh? He said. I was in a room, not a crate, Amaru replied tersely. I wasn't waiting to be let out again on good behavior. I'm my own ghost. Then you should join me in Ido. No. But we're collecting inspiration for scary stories, starting with our research on the headless ones in the hall between. Headless what? Headless ones, Glint chirped. Giant pumpkin-headed enemies that the Guardians have been fighting. They're mysterious monsters filled with candy. Fighting the Guardians, In that case, I'd love to hear what your little fallen friend has to say about them.
Yeah, so
These books are
that's
always
good
so
dialogue.
fun.
Yeah, and it's cool because like now you have a little bit more perspective as to why he was so just raw dogging everybody that was in there, shooting the headless ones constantly. He was just in there, just verbally assaulting all the guardians as they're trying to get all this candy and loot, you know. Yeah, remember
Yeah, that makes sense
Amaru's in there
now.
talking smack to everybody? Yeah.
And Ikora kept having to come in and be like, "All right, tomorrow, come back home."
All right, so the next chapter. So Ido sat in the tower's bazaar beneath the afternoon sun, comfortably situated at a table with a full pot of tea. She gazed intently into her cup, her research and data spread out around her. Ido, Amaru is going to Ido, what why are you staring at your tea instead of writing? Glint peered at her in confusion, Amaru in tow. I was going to write, but then I discovered the art of now this is a word, tassiomancy. While following an old research lead, she said, her eyes never leaving her cup. Apparently, it's a method of discerning things yet to come by assessing patterns within the leaves and sediment. I thought it might help. I was looking for monsters, not tea, Amaru growled. Glint peeked over Ido's shoulder, watching the leaves move in her drink. Ido squinted her four eyes. This pattern looks like Commander Zavala knitting an Empress Keitel, Glint exclaimed. Ido watched the leaves swirl around in the tea in the shape of a ragged claw, and a sharp chill suddenly settled deep inside her. No, it's Finch with a lucent knight? No. A hunter? No, wait, he's hugging Sabathun? Glint called out again. Why did I think for one second this was going to be worth my while? Amaru muttered and left.
Yeah, I get why people get annoyed by Glint. He's a little much.
He is. Yeah.
So
It's just funny they're using the old like study the tea leaves and stuff as a way to try to figure out,
chapter 7. Forget the tea, Glint said. I've got something better. He transmitted a set of objects onto the table and Ido gasped, her heartbeat
Oh yeah.
quickening. The deck of whispers? You stole Eris's cards? Borrowed, he corrected, twirling around the table to face her. Glint, what? I left a note. Ido shivered as she conjured the image of a hive-altered Eris in her mind. It's too dangerous. She quickly pushed the cards away, but Glint nudged them back. I heard that Eris consulted the deck to gain information or make decisions. I thought we could use it to inspire your writing. Let's just try, Glint begged. How hard can it be? Ido sighed and picked up the cards, shuffling them with her four hands in the flamboyant style the drifter taught her. How many cards? She asked. Try three, Glint said. And when I watched Eris, she had to ask what cards she had to ask the cards a question. Ido thought for a moment. What kind of danger would be threatening enough for a scary story? Ido cut the deck in half and felt a surge of energy as she selected the first card, the Harbinger. Wait, I've got a better one. What kind of dangerous situation could be happening right now? Glint exclaimed. Glint, I don't think we should. We need to write based off a true story, right? This is exactly how we do it. Ido closed her eyes, feeling the energy surge again in her hands, and continued. The lie, three of worms. She opened her eyes and studied the cards. Eris can be, well, intimidating, she admitted, pointing to the Harbinger card. No, the cards aren't literal. It's a metaphor, Glint said. The Harbinger and the lie, that means the spirits of the dead are lost like leaves in the wind and wandering the earth, Glint gasped. But the lie is upside down. That wouldn't make sense. It's right side up to me, but you're on the opposite side of the table. It's my reading, remember? Oh, yeah, he quickly changed position. Then they aren't lost. They have purpose. They seek revenge against the living by changing us into headless ones with paracausal worm power. Ah! Ido pondered the cards. Actually, I was thinking that solitude and being isolated can evoke terror in both human and Elixni. Perhaps my scariest story could include that. Glint shrugged his shell. Not bad. I still like mine better. Maybe try it again? Ido nodded and swept the cards up to shuffle once more.
Yeah, so there's like this is a perfect example of something buried in between something really funny and entertaining.
Yeah, I agree.
So like, and this is what we talk about a lot on the show. Bungie loves, or the writers love to like touch on something that's an overarching theme, or it could be coming down later in the story beats. So here you have them playing around with some, a potentially dangerous cards that Eris uses, to, do her incantations and whatnot. And they're reading their fortune, but you're twisted in this, like, okay, whose fortune is this? What does this really mean? So if you take the cards on face value, like Glint, or like they mistakenly did at the beginning, you're led to think, what, the Harbinger, the lie, the three of worms, like how are they tied together, right? And then when they get into the specifics of it, no, their interpretations for the person that they're reading it to, at first they're like, okay, well, this means we're just lost and we don't know what we're doing. And then the other thing was, no, it's a story of revenge and we're going after, something. But the thing that I queue up on, or that the thing that I key on right off the bat, is the Harbingers. Because we know now there's a story beat that could potentially lead us back to the old Harbingers that Mara had, and how that whole thing worked out in the planting of seeds, and how she kept one in reserve. So maybe one day we'll learn some more about that.
So that actually has me thinking. I wonder, like, clearly we can't interpret the Harbinger of the Lie and Three of Worms to mean anything, because like what could we interpret that to be? But what if we were to take what Glint said at face value, the Harbinger and the Lie, that means the spirits of the dead are lost like leaves on the wind and wandering the earth. So maybe it's not completely accurate. Maybe this is a reach, but I wonder if this has anything to do with Final Shape. With like, we know that like a spirit of Cade is kind of coming back.
Interesting.
Or
I don't know, man.
could this actually just be Riven, the spirit of Riven?
Oh, yeah. That could have been that too.
But
Like this was
then,
talking about.
well, I was gonna say, and then if we follow it all the way, the lie is upside down, that wouldn't make sense. Wandering the earth for revenge. They have purpose, they seek revenge. What if Riven is looking for revenge? Like what if that's what that's like what if this is about Riven? What if this season will end with Riven revenge?
Yeah. That's scary. Or it could be Savathun, or it could be, Zivu is in some human form or something.
I'm
Who
just trying to think
knows?
of a spirit.
Or it could just be talking about Eris as a whole,
Yeah.
how she got revenge. But yeah, there's a lot. That's crazy, dude. See, this is why, everybody should be reading these lores and coming up with their own like interpretations and theories, because a lot of collective heads out there could, bang around and come up with some pretty cool ideas as to what's happening, or some good ideas as to what happened. I don't think there's enough of that these days, maybe because how Destiny as a whole has just been in its place. But yeah, maybe we'll get back to that golden day one day. So the next chapter 8, the colors of dusk were already painted in the sky before the last city by the time Glint approached Crow, stationed on the outskirts of the tower. Crow, you'll never believe what happened today. Ido and I were talking. I mean, we talk a lot, but today about the Headless Ones. And then she got the idea to write a scary story. And then Ida was going to write, but then she didn't. I mean, she did, but first tea, it didn't help. So I borrowed Eris's deck of whispers, and the cards are incredible. No wonder Eris. Glint stopped and saw Crow's gaze following a squadron's contrails in the far off distance. The ghost floated up and nudged Crow's cheek. The hunter jumped in startled surprise. Glint, I didn't see you there. Did you say something? Crow asked. Just that I'm here if you want to talk. Glint leaned against his guardian's shoulder, and Crow reached up to touch the little ghost's shell. Little sweet interaction between Crow and Glint.
I wonder if Crow sighs when, for the third year in a row, Glint comes back and he's on the fucking Headless Ones train again. It's like, yep, okay, here we go. Headless Ones. Yep, okay.
It's cute though, because nobody takes Glint really seriously, but he does happen to pop up in some really serious moments. Like, I mean, the whole resurrection of Crow, and as a whole, that just right then and there is, I think it's really good that they chose a character like Glint to be Crow's ghost, just because how, silly he is, but how important he has become. And he's a lovable person, because he's like, he's simple. I don't want to say simple minded, but just like, more pure at heart, more childlike.
Yeah, I get you. So chapter 9, Imaru materializes again in the corner of the courtyard, not far from the bust of Cade 6. He continued his studies, watching guardians obediently crowd around a human with more candy, lots of candy, in fact. Her laughter pealed like mesmerizing bells as she bestowed her confections, the guardians seeming to respond to her every command. Subjugation by sucrose, Imaru thought to himself, much less messy than the hive way. Huh. What I wouldn't give to try it out myself, he chuckled out loud at the thought. An oblivious titan stopped directly in front of him, adjusting his giant chicken mask with one hand while cradling a mound of confections in the other. Bacawk, a chicken charged the titan. He gasped and quickly dropped his bounty of candy in front of the ironwood tree, hands outstretched in a semblance surrender. The chicken feverishly flapped her wings and mercilessly pecked his fingers. Colonel, it's me, the Titan cried out in agony, trying to yank his mask loose. I'm not a chicken. Mask wedged askew, the Titan ran and frantically barreled straight through Amaru. The ghost slammed into Colonel with a solid thud. Bacawk, the chicken focused her rage on Amaru and snapped at his shell. She found purchase on the silver snake decoration and clamped down. Let go, Imaru yelled, wishing he had his hive shell to swat the bird away. He sped through the courtyard toward the hangar, but Colonel had the strength of a titan, the finesse of a hunter, and the cunning of a warlock, and held on the whole way.
That's so funny. Yeah, it's funny too, because this is like, hey, you notice that Colonel is standing by the Cade statue now in the tower. So like, he was down in the hangar, but now he's up there by the statue, kind of pecking
I actually
around.
didn't notice that. That's funny.
Yeah, see what I mean? So it's like, a lot of people didn't know that.
That's a great way to make you realize it.
All right, so this one I thought was kind of cool because I actually read this one. I read some of, I didn't really digest these all that great, which is fun for now because I'm getting to see some cool stuff. But this one was this one I remember. So chapter 10, Anna Bray passed through the courtyard, her mechanical dog at her heels. Happy Festival of the Lost, Eva. Oh, Anna dear, Eva called back and held out a small package. I thought Archie deserved to celebrate the festival in style with his own costume this year. Anna gasped softly with delight as she unfurled the tiny cloak. Look at you, Archie. I always knew you were a hunter at heart. She bent to secure the cloak just as the ghost came zipping in from the direction of the hangar, a rage-filled chicken hanging off his tail. Archie's cloak flapped over Ghost's eye. Unable to see, the ghost skipped and skidded along the floor of the courtyard, landing in the abandoned pile of candy beneath the ironwood tree. Colonel's beak shook loose on impact. She expertly bobbed and weaved around the candy, her pecking focused on the ghost's eye. And then it's like the stars, the break. Mechanical barks sounded, and among the candy wrappers, Amaru saw a flurry of feathers fly past. Eventually, the squawking faded into the distance. Amaro sat motionless until he felt the dog's nose nuzzled softly against him. Only then did the flustered ghost emerge from hiding. Aw, look at that. Archie saved that little ghost from Colonel's wrath. What a good little hunter. A guardian cooed. Amaru watched in awe as every guardian in the courtyard simultaneously forgot about the candy, their attention devoted exclusively to the dog. Incredible, he mused with fascination.
The secret is dogs. I just need a dog and I can control all the guardians. All right. Well, we're getting really close, so why don't we read this last one, this short one here, and that will be one third of all of the whole book. And I think that'll just be
Yeah,
like a
sounds
nice place
good.
to stop. So chapter 11. Maru eventually found Archie again, sleeping and curled on a blanket in the annex. The ghost approximated the guttural sound of clearing one's throat, and the dog opened one eye. You know, after the whole chicken thing, I saw what you did up there. Those guardians in the courtyard, the way you had them wrapped around your little, paws. You've got a gift, Amaru said, and I could really use your help. Archie tilted his head, listening. Right now, those guardians don't care about anything else besides candy. It's controlling them, and they'll do anything for it, so we gotta get control of it instead. Archie growled. Not to hurt the guardians, Amaru said, feigned sincerity dripping in his voice. Just to help them. You wanna help Anna, don't you? Keep her safe? Archie processed for a moment, then barked in agreement, sealing their pact. That's actually a great way to end, because that's like a little cliffhanger as well.
I like it. That's funny.
What is
Oh.
Amaru gonna do to Archie? Find out next time on Loose Cannonball Z.
Same bat channel, same bat time.
So we'll be back again on the 21st. We should be back into the rhythm of doing a show every other week. We've been delayed a week, I think two or three times now because of all the holiday nonsenses that have been going on. But that should, and I probably just jinxed it, but that should be all over now. So if you want to find more of us, find us on Twitter at Loose Cannon Show. We got our pinned tweet. It's got everything. This show will go up, the audio, the video, everywhere, YouTube and Spotify and Google and Apple and etc. So, hope everybody had a good time. We'll see you next episode.
Bye.
Bye.